Data, data everywhere, and not a darn bit of control over who has it and where it goes. That's not a very good poem, but it is pretty good business. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, March 29th. Thank you for joining us. We begin today with an update on Infrastructure Week. Yes, that is still happening. Maybe. President Trump traveled to Ohio today to pump his infrastructure proposal, a $1.5 trillion project that only includes about $200 billion from the federal government. State and local governments, along with the private sector, would have to come up with the rest. And that's going to be a tough sell because states and cities are already cash-strapped. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains why.
Before state and local governments can spend anything on infrastructure, they've got a number of bills to pay. John Hicks heads the National Association of State Budget Officers. First up, he says, Medicaid.
And Medicaid has, over the last two decades, generally grown at a rate higher than state revenues.
He says that's because of increasing enrollment and higher health care costs. In fact, the association estimates that in 2015, Medicaid alone accounted for more than a quarter of total state spending. Hicks says there are also costs for public worker pension plans, and they're on the rise, in some cases because investments made to fund them didn't pan out.
In other cases, the inability to take away or limit benefits that have already been promised.
After those bills are paid, there's less money for infrastructure. Money for that could be borrowed, but the tax overhaul made it harder for state and local governments to raise money in the municipal bond market. Those tax-free bonds may not be as appealing to investors, says Tracy Gordon of the Urban Institute.
If you have a lower tax rate, then you get less of a benefit from holding tax-free bonds, and so they might not be as attractive to you anymore.
States and municipalities could raise taxes to pay for their share of President Trump's infrastructure plan, but that's a tough sell. Just ask Columbia, South Carolina Mayor Steve Benjamin.
You got to be able to make a really, really good case, particularly in the wake of the tax cut bill, to raise taxes on them locally.
Benjamin says state and local politicians will be asking members of Congress to allocate more federal money for infrastructure. After all, they still have to approve the funding for the president's infrastructure plan. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We've been talking a lot about Facebook and Cambridge Analytica and elections this week, but the real story is less about elections and more about data. No matter what business you're in, you can never have too much of the stuff, and the more specific, the better. Even Facebook needs more data. And until yesterday, it was getting outside information from companies called data brokers, companies like Experian and Acxiom, who buy and sell consumer data. Well, Facebook now says it won't let advertisers use information from those companies to target users on its platform. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank looks at the world of data brokers and what this means for them.
Facebook knows a lot about its users. It tracks their every like, search, check-in, chat. But data brokers know things Facebook doesn't. Jenny Gebhardt is a researcher with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She says big data firms collect information from some pretty specific sources.
Surveys, public records, store loyalty cards, home ownership records, magazine subscriptions.
Combine that with what Facebook has, and Gebhardt says
that can result in some kind of turbocharged, targeted advertising.
But that engine is about to stall, and advertisers will have to rely on their own data and data Facebook itself collects. Brian Weiser at Pivotal Research says some companies will have a harder time advertising on the platform now.
If you are a manufacturer, a packaged goods company, you tend not to have a lot of data about the people who buy your products because the retailers have that data.
Data brokers will also take a hit after the breakup. Acxiom, one of the biggest, says revenue could fall more than 5% next year. Catherine Armstrong at law firm Drinker Biddle has studied data brokers. She says the average one doubles the size of its database every 2 years.
So there's so much data and so much data exhaust that can be picked up in so many of our transactions or even toll booths or Fitbits.
Even with Facebook's move, the big data economy will keep chugging. Rob Beeler is founder of ad tech research firm Beeler.tech.
Data is the new oil. What marketers are looking for is to put the right message in front of the right person at the right time. And the only way you can do that is with data.
Facebook says it'll unwind its broker partnerships over the next 6 months. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
This question of data has been a hot topic on Make Me Smart, the podcast hosted by me and also Kai Rizdahl. This week, we talked about how the phone you use can make a big difference in how much of your data gets shared. Android. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. On Wall Street Today, it was bad again, and then all of a sudden it was really, really good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Now for another story about data being used in unintended ways. The Environmental Protection Agency is about to make a big change that powerful industries have been asking for decades. The change is to the way the agency vets scientific studies, say one that links a chemical to cancer. Those studies will now have to be more transparent and show their work. Critics, though, say the move may be less about transparency and more about giving opponents of regulation the opportunity to undermine the science. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Here's the Trump administration's version of the story. It is bringing transparency to academic studies that lead to regulation. Show your work, root out secret science. Here's EPA head Scott Pruitt in an Oregon radio interview last Thursday.
I'm issuing a memo here pretty soon that says, look, as we do rulemaking, if we use science outside the agency with a third party, the methodology and data needs to be transparent and objective for the American people to consume.
Under the new policy, scientific study authors will have to share their raw data so it can be picked apart and chewed over. Bravo, says Jim Tozzi. He's worked in the past for chemical and tobacco interests.
If you want to get into this hot game, you got to take the heat. And if you can't, put your laboratory coat and stay with the rats.
But here's the thing. Raw data can get twisted and distorted, says retired epidemiologist Colin Soskolny. There's an old saying, the data are like captured spies. Torture them and they'll tell you what you want.
Anyone with malevolent intent can take your data and tease out of data anything that you wanted to say.
It happened to him. In the 1970s, he found a link between oil refinery workers and throat cancer. The refinery belonged to Exxon.
The corporation employed the services of a private consulting firm of epidemiologists and at the time paid them handsomely, as I understand it, to, so to speak, kill the finding.
To critics of this EPA, what's really going on here is that the regulators don't want to regulate. Epidemiologist David Michaels is a former worker safety regulator. His book on industry influence over science is called Doubt is Their Product.
This is an attempt to handcuff the EPA and to stop them from using new science to protect the public. People will die. Exposure to pollution kills thousands of people a year.
He dates this tactic to tobacco industry strategy memos. Today, this new process could undercut several rules, including one on what's called PM2.5. It's a key pollutant linked to heart disease and asthma. Former coal executive Steve Malloy served on the transition team for the current EPA.
The benefits of the Clean Air Act depend on the notion that PM2.5 kills people. Now, I personally think the science is lousy.
Malloy attended a recent meeting with EPA head Pruitt, and he says many more science changes are coming to the agency. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The music streaming platform Spotify plans to go public next week. And whatever the outcome of that IPO, there is a lot of interest in what Spotify subscribers are doing. Yes, this is also a story about data. It's the last one, I promise. It's about the data that comes from who plays music and how often, and how Billboard, which controls the Hot 100 music charts, uses that data to rank a song's popularity. Turns out, not all streaming platforms are created equal. Marketplace's Peter Ballin and Rosen has the story.
Casa Amadeo in the Bronx is the oldest Latin music store in New York City. And here we can see how songs used to become hits. That's musician, composer, and owner Mike Amadeo. Now, his songs never topped the charts, but up until the mid-90s, he helped make them. He'd get an envelope in the mail every month from Billboard with a list of new music, and he had to respond with what was selling.
And I used to write it, seal it, put a stamp on it, and send it to them.
Billboard would gather info and put together their charts. But like any system, it could be gamed. Record labels would try and get people to fudge numbers with gifts. Amadeo points to a signed poster of the singer Selena sent from her record company.
If you read what he says there, it's ridiculous. You know, send me kisses, gracias por el apoyo, blessing me because I'm such a nice guy.
Amadeo says he never caved. And as technology changed, so did ranking music. In the 90s, Billboard started tracking sales through store computers. And by 2013, Billboard's Hot Charts looked at sales, radio play, and streaming on places like Spotify and YouTube.
It was a little crazy. I think for a lot of people, they were still dubious about what streaming was going to mean.
Gary Suarez is a music critic and journalist. Today, almost half, about 46% of time spent streaming music is on YouTube. And it became a new system for record labels to manipulate, like with rapper Post Malone's Rockstar.
What they did was they created a YouTube video. It was only the song's chorus, but the length of the video was precisely the length of the actual song.
The video's description had a link to hear the full song, but that chorus loop was close enough in likeness that plays of both counted for the charts. Rockstar topped Billboard's Hot 100 for 8 weeks last year.
It's become the new promotion strategy to instruct your fans where to listen to music.
Rapper Cardi B's fans urged people to stream the song Bodak Yellow on repeat to push her into Billboard's number one spot. She celebrated on Instagram.
Bodak Yellow is the first solo female rap single to reach number one, the Hot 100.
But now the charts are changing. Billboard wouldn't talk to us, but they sent a press release. It says plays on paid platforms, so from Apple Music users or Spotify subscribers, will get more weight than plays on free services like YouTube. They say not all listens are equal from a revenue perspective. Charts should reflect that. Jim Ledestri, CEO of Border City Media, which makes Buzz Angle Music, another ranking chart, says they too give more weight to streamers who pay.
If I'm not really paying anything for it, you know, am I listening to, you know, things that I really maybe don't care about as much or lower down in the value chain?
Or maybe you don't have the means to pay for your music. Think about this. Spotify has 71 million subscribers, but 1.3 billion users stream music on YouTube. And that's boosted more Spanish language and rap songs onto the charts than ever. So Billboard's rule changes make some people nervous. Again, music critic Gary Suarez.
Whitewashing is a definite concern with this. You know, if we look back a year from now at those charts and see the number one spot was largely held by traditional, conventional pop singers, then that's going to raise some questions about whether or not this was such a good idea.
Still, artists and record labels are directing fans to listen to music on paid platforms. Because with a new system comes new ways to work it. From New York, I'm Peter Ballinon-Rosen for Marketplace.
Coming up.
If you'll give me a fine of $100 and annoy me a lot, I will be very happy to pay the $100 fine and just tell you what I think about you.
Do those big fines in professional sports actually work? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 254 points, 1% to close at 24,103. The NASDAQ increased 114 points, 1.6% to finish at 7063. And the S&P 500 boosted 35 points, 1.3% to end at 2640. With the market closed for the Good Friday holiday tomorrow, let's have a look at where things landed for the week. The Dow added 2.2%. The NASDAQ eked out 1% and the S&P rose 2% for the quarter. The Dow was down 2.25%. We talked about the user data goldmine as Facebook cut ties with those big brokers. Let's look at how they fare today. Tech marketer Axiom scraped off 19%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.74%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
You go first this time.
Hey, I'm Molly Wood.
And I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Our podcast, Make Me Smart, is back, and we are exploring something you need to succeed in business, politics, you know, basically everywhere.
It is the art, the lost art, some might say, of compromise.
Yeah, because this country is not going to get where it needs to go. Frankly, you and your boss are not going to get where you need to go if you cannot even get people in the room.
We're not doing the room.
The
right
room
now.
Where it happens.
We're not.
How come we can't? Can we just compromise on this one issue?
No.
Just sing like a little bit?
No. Check us out at makemesmart.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. After the Parkland, Florida shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, President Trump called the game industry to the White House and suggested that violence in video games could be responsible for real-world violence. Research has shown that there isn't that connection. But to find out how game developers think about this in their work, I spoke to Kate Edwards. She's the executive director of Take This, a mental health nonprofit, and the former executive director of the International Game Developers Association. Kate, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
So obviously there's, you know, a renewed conversation, as there so kind of often is, about violence in video games. And what we really want to know is what are designers and developers saying? You know, are there lines that get drawn in the kind of creative stage of developing video games?
Well, there are. I mean, there's obviously a lot of discussions that go into developing a video game. You know, there, when it comes to issues like violence, the degree of violence and the depiction of certain acts and things like that, I think a lot of people think that they just gratuitously believe like, oh, we'll just throw in some blood there and throw in some here. And it's like, no, that's not really what happens. I mean, it really does come down to serving the game design and the narrative. And so in some cases, having more realistic violence and having more realistic acts serves the narrative of the particular world that the game creators have made. And in other cases, it just doesn't matter because, you know, like explicit gore or anything like that, because it's just, there's no point. It's not really what the game is about.
And can you give me some examples of things that are absolutely left out? I mean, I know there's obviously ratings and there's things like that, but can you think of anything specific that you've ever seen a developer say, okay, we can't do that?
So, for example, I worked on a lot of the Dead Rising games that have come out over the last several years. And those games, you're committing, you know, pretty violent acts against zombies. You're killing these zombies, these creatures that are certainly human-looking. And in those particular game series, one of the features of that of the series is kind of the graphic nature at which you destroy the zombies. And so some of the acts that were committed, there were a couple times where we just felt that the nature of what you're seeing was just too much.
And how is the industry receiving this round of rhetoric and conversation from the White House and sort of renewed conversation about violence in video games?
Well, I think in general, the industry is having another eye-rolling moment. A lot of people are like, the reactions that I hear in a lot of developer communities, both in the US and in Europe and other places, is kind of this, like, really? Again, we're still talking about this? But there are a lot of discussions around it. There's a lot of, I think, frustration around it. When I see the photo of like the ESA and the ESRB meeting with President Trump, I basically view that as a complete failure on the part of the game industry. We have lost control of the public narrative. I'm not sure we ever really had it, to be honest. And when I see the fact that we have to keep explaining and re-explaining what we do and what our craft means and all of these kind of different issues, that's us not doing a good enough job helping reach out to the public, including, you know, the public sector, the government and whatnot, to help them understand this is what game development is. And we're not just sitting around in a room dreaming of new ways to make violence in video games.
Yeah. What does that message look like, do you think? What would an effective message look like?
I think to me, a lot of it has to come from the developers themselves. And I often challenge them and say, well, when's the last time you actually called up your local representative and invited them to your studio and showed them how games get made and walked them through how decisions around these kind of issues get made and allow them to ask those challenging questions about, you know, like, why did you do it that way? Or why does that violent act occur? And what was your thought process behind it? I think those are really important forms of outreach to kind of open up the black box of game development and help people understand the intent behind decisions that get made.
Kate Edwards, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Today is opening day in Major League Baseball, the earliest opening day in the history of America's pastime. I can't believe I'm sitting here in this studio right now. Those of you at the game will be shelling out money for peanuts and Cracker Jacks, but if you're a player and you didn't obey team and league rules, you might have to shell out money for fines. That fine might even be considered peanuts in some cases. Okay, I'm done. The question of fines got our listeners thinking, one of our listeners, and it's the latest installment of our series, I've Always Wondered.
My name's Peter Bailey. I live in Plano, Texas. And one thing I've always wondered is, what are the economics of fines in major sports? Who sets the prices? Where does the money go? Is there any evidence that these fines disincentivize the underlying behavior?
A lot going on there for Marketplace's Andy Euler to try to answer from KUT in Austin, Texas.
Sport in America is a $70 billion business and includes everything from Major League Soccer to the Kentucky Derby. But when most people talk about sports, they tend to focus on the major four: football, baseball, basketball, and hockey. Each has its own three-letter acronym leagues, the NFL, MLB, NBA, and NHL, and those leagues have different structures. But they all deal with fining their players in the same way, through a collective bargaining agreement, or CBA.
The CBA only deals with interest between the league and the players, so player fines are the only thing that's covered.
Larry Kuhn is the general manager of Sports Business Classroom and an expert on the basketball agreement.
The CBA does put in certain specific amounts for fines for things that are league type of violations.
Miss a practice, that's $2,500. Miss a promotional event, that could cost you $20,000. Your team can fine you too. These fines are starting to add up. With the NBA's agreement, half of that money goes to the league's charities, the rest to causes picked by the players' union. However, the league won't disclose exactly where those player fines end up.
Then the other kind of fines are against teams themselves or against executives or owners of the teams.
Kuhn says doling out those fines in the NBA falls to one person in the league's office, the executive vice president of basketball operations, Kiki Vandeweghe. Last month, the league fined Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban $600,000 for comments he made suggesting his team might be losing on purpose this year. Where does all that money end up? Cuban's answer via email was pretty vague. He said it, quote, usually goes to our philanthropic endeavors. That's about as specific as the leagues get, too. The NFL says much of its fine money goes to organizations that help out former players. Same with Major League Hockey. Baseball funnels its fines to a central fund that's then shared among the league's 30 teams. But does fining players actually work?
In this case, it usually depends on the size of the fine.
Rignese is a behavioral economist at the University of California, San Diego. He says if you're a pro athlete making $10 million a year, a $1,500 fine for yelling at a referee is not going to sting very much. Rignese says it ends up being a cost-benefit analysis.
If you'll give me a fine of $100 and annoy me a lot, I will be very happy to pay the $100 fine and just tell you what I think about you.
The leagues don't adjust the fines based on how much a player makes. That'd be like getting a much higher parking ticket if you drove a Rolls Royce than if you drove, say, a Kia. Before January 1st this year, if a player got fined by his team or the league, that fine was tax deductible. It was considered a business expense. Now?
All unreimbursed employee business expenses, fines, agent fees, union dues, they are no longer deductible.
Robert Rayl is a sports tax accountant at PKF O'Connor Davies.
So the players would no longer get a tax benefit for these fines.
Whether that change in tax law affects how players behave, we'll have to see as the year progresses. Because, as Rayola reminds us,
it's not what you make, it's what you keep.
He says it's not like players rack up fines to get a tax break, but this tax law could lead to some changes, and the game might benefit too. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Andy Euler, I should note, big baseball fan. He filed that story about 30 minutes before the Rangers game started today. This series obviously only works because of you and your questions, so let us know what you have always wondered at marketplace.org. And this final note before we go, I'm going to admit that Kai Rizdahl sent me this one, maybe because he is ghostwriting the show from afar, or because he knows I'm a bit of a sneakerhead. Running shoe favorite Saucony has a new shoe for the Boston Marathon, which happens the third Monday of April. Saucony is in a carbo-loading partnership with Dunkin' Donuts. The shoe is magenta, white, and orange, like the store colors. The heel of the shoe is a sprinkled donut, and you can choose between insoles with pictures of hot or iced coffee. The limited edition shoe went on sale today for $110, and no, don't bother. I checked it out. It's already sold out. And that's it for me. Today, the Dow Industrial Average added 254 points, a percent. The NASDAQ increased 114 points, 1 6/10%. And the S&P 500 boosted 35 points. That was 1 1/3%. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I am Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.